This is the CPC Podcast, Episode 5 for September 2nd, 2018, A True Reflection. This podcast was recorded live at Central Presbyterian Church in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I'm your host, Zach Cosner. Today on the pod, we welcome Reverend Timothy Reeves. Reverend Reeves is the pastor at First Presbyterian Church in Stuttgart, Arkansas. He's also a product of Central Pres, having attended services here as a child through adolescence. Stick around after the sermon for news and notes from CPC. With the introductions out of the way, let's go ahead and turn it over to Reverend Reeves.
I once read about a group of indigenous people in southwestern Mexico called the Mazatec Indians. And one of the more fascinating things about this group of people is how they relate to one another. For instance, they seldom wish someone well. Moreover, they are hesitant, if they are not downright refusing to, or if they do not outright refuse to teach others or pass along knowledge that they have acquired through the years. So, for example, if the village baker were asked, "Who was it that taught you how to bake such delicious bread?" the baker would respond, "I just know," meaning that he or she has acquired these skills and this knowledge without anyone's help. They certainly would not go to the trouble of wishing someone a good or blessed day, because they operate out of a worldview that scientists or anthropologists have labeled limited good. And they believe that there is only so much good, so much prosperity, so many blessings available in the world. There's a finite amount. Once it's gone, it's gone. So much knowledge, only so much love to give. And to teach someone else an important skill means that you yourself would be diminished. To love a second child means for them that they must love their first child less. To wish someone well, to even say something like "have a good" or "a blessed day" means that for them, they must end up having a worse day because they've given away some of their blessing. There is, in short, among these people a real fear that seeking the well-being of another will, in the end, mean the end to their own well-being. And I thought about that a lot this week as I read this morning's scripture passages. And I think that at first blush, it's very tempting for us all to want to dismiss the behavior of the Mazatec Indians as primitive and selfish. That notion of limited good seems to be little more than superstition. We, after all, live in a country of abundance. But if we're truly honest with ourselves as Christians and as Americans, I think that we would have to honestly say that there are times when we operate out of a similar world view. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So asserted Thomas Jefferson when he penned the Declaration of Independence. And those noble words, I think, capture the essence, the very best of who we are and what we are called to be as a nation. But what happens when one group in this country actually stakes a claim to those self-evident truths? What happens when someone else demands to be treated as an equal, and that means suddenly that we who are in positions of power or superiority are suddenly called into question? Is it not our first reaction to respond out of a notion of limited good? There's only so much equality to go around, and so you have to wait your turn. Now, over the centuries of, or over the years in this country's history, that's basically what we have told Native Americans, blacks, the Irish, Asians, women, just to name a few. Wait your turn. We can't shake things up too much and upset the status quo. There's only so much equality to go around. There's been a fear in this country that ensuring the well-being of some will, by its very nature, result in the diminishment of our own well-being. But why? Why, when we have been so richly and abundantly blessed by God and God's grace, and to enjoy freedoms the likes of which are still the envy the world over, do we offer or act out of a sense of scarcity? Which led me to our reading from James this morning. James reminds us that we are endowed by our Creator with an abundance that can never, ever fade away. Every generous act of giving, with every perfect gift, is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Stinginess is not in our Creator's vocabulary. Scarcity is not in our Creator's vocabulary. Selfishness is not the modus operandi of our God. It's a concept utterly foreign to the one who willingly and graciously and abundantly blesses us with life and everything we need for a joy-filled and abundant life. We, as human beings created in the image of this very generous God, are called upon to be a true reflection of that God. But we turn a blind eye to those who are in need or fail to remember God's generosity, and we find ourselves governed by notions of limited good. I love what Harry Emerson Fosdick once wrote. He observed that in his experience, those who reflect upon their lives and conclude that they have received far less than they deserve tend to be among those from whom no great living comes. If they haven't gotten what they thought they deserved, they're going to be selfish and self-centered. And then he says there's another group that falls into a, well, I guess I've broken kind of even mentality. And they conclude they've just about gotten what they've earned, but there's no real exceptional living from them either. Then he said this: those who readily reckon they have received far more than they deserve are among those who indulge in great living. Look at the cross of Jesus Christ. How can any of us say that we have not received far more than we deserve? Are we not therefore called upon to indulge in great living? That's exactly what James is exhorting the people of God to do when he says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is great living. Great living is being doers of the word and not simply hearers of it, for in hearing alone we can deceive ourselves. Doing the word means caring for orphans and widows in their distress and keeping oneself unstained by the world. Great living, being a true reflection of our God, is to live a life governed by love, not fear. It is to live lives confident in the abundance of God, rather than convinced that if we actively seek someone else's well-being, the scarcity of resources will mean that we must, by logic, go without. I find it interesting that James referred to the orphans and the widows because those were the people in his day and age that were the most vulnerable in society. In the patriarchal world, women and children were the disposable and expendable people of the day, ranking just above slaves. But who is it today that we as a society deem are disposable and expendable? What about the children in the detainment facilities separated from their parents? Are they disposable? Are they expendable? What about the nameless folk who, or unknown named people we encounter every day who are suffering? Maybe silently, maybe quite visibly, homeless, destitute, abused. We could just as easily insert them in the place of widows and orphans today, couldn't we? And James's point would remain the same. We, who have received so much from the hands of a generous God, are called to be generous in turn to everyone we encounter. Such care for the most vulnerable does not and cannot merit the generosity of God, but springs from the fact that God has already been so generous to us. We can't work our way into heaven, but we can work to bring heaven here to earth. And if we are to be a true reflection of God, then we must not be afraid to get our hands dirty, which of course I think is the broader message that we heard in Mark's gospel this morning. Now, one thing I have said in my, and it's hard for me to believe, but it is true, this September 7th, I will mark my 21st year in ordained ministry. But one thing I have said time and again from the pulpit in Stuttgart is that we love to hate the Pharisees because the gospel writers loved to hate the Pharisees. But we should remember that they were, for the most part, good and sincere people who took their religion seriously and who wanted to protect the people of Israel from the contaminating influences of the Roman Empire. They did not want their people to be led astray. They were followers of the one true God, and they demanded ethical action and observance of the law, and it is because of their hard work and their dedication that Judaism exists today. They resisted, sometimes rather perilously, assimilation from the surrounding pagan religious and social groups. They knew from experience that separating themselves from other people's belief systems was dangerous, but it was the only way to protect their people and their designation as God's chosen people. They knew that God claimed sovereignty over every aspect of their lives. They also knew that the laws for their religious leaders were stricter than those for common people. Their religious leaders were rightly held to a higher standard. So it was in this light that they observed Jesus and looked at his disciples and asked him why they would not, or he would not require that they wash their hands before they eat. It was a sanitary offense, right? My mama always told me, wash my hands before I eat. But I never really got in serious trouble if I didn't. So why would the Pharisees make such a big deal? Well, it wasn't a sanitary offense for them. It was a holiness offense. You see, hygiene was never the issue. There was no law which required the washing of one's hands before eating, but there was a provision in the law which required a priest to wash his hands and feet before ministering at the altar of God. And later, in addition to that, a human doctrine and tradition developed dictating that the priest not only would wash his hands and feet, but because the priests were given a portion of any sacrifice to feed themselves and their families, would then have to wash their hands before eating it. And again, in order to preserve holiness. And as time went on, the Pharisees said, well, if we are going to remain truly distinct from the pagan culture around us, everyone should ascribe to this. Then along comes Jesus' disciples, and they put their grubby hands in the food, and the rest, they say, is history. But Jesus responds that it's not what goes into a person that defiles us. It's not what goes into us that makes us unholy. Rather, it's what comes out of us. It's our priorities. There are far more important things in life than little dirt under the fingernails. It's much more important to exhibit a faith which encompasses the whole of life, a religion that does not just follow the letter of God's law, but adheres as well to the spirit of the law. And to make his point, Jesus brings up the issue of Corban. Now, in my studies on this passage, I learned some very interesting things about Corban. Apparently, one could make a vow that one's wealth and resources were dedicated to God. They could go to the temple and make this grand and glorious announcement that all of my worldly possessions, I'm handing over to God. But as long as that person remained alive, they could still use those resources and that wealth and benefit from them. And in an age where there was no social safety net and children were responsible for caring for their aged parents, there were some who said, I owe you nothing because I have dedicated this all to God. It is Corban. Your hands can't touch it. I can use it, but then God gets it. Sorry, Mom. Sorry, Dad. You're on your own. Thanks for raising me. Love you very much. Have a nice life. And Jesus said, what? What? The God of heaven and earth who commanded you to honor your father and mother would never find such a thing holy or acceptable, never would command such a thing, and yet your own tradition says this is okay, and I'm the one who's defiling our people because my disciples don't wash their hands? Have you lost your minds? Have I woken up in the twilight zone? See how far sin moves us from the will of God. And suddenly what seems utterly fantastic becomes our reality. But Jesus says, if you really want to be a reflection of God and God's holiness, don't worry so much about getting your hands dirty, but rather dig your arms in to the muck and mire of human suffering and show some love and compassion. Reflect that in your life. Show hospitality. Welcome the outsider. Remember that the goodness of God knows no limits. The love God shares with us today, how does the song, the 23rd Psalm puts it? My cup runneth over. Well, if our cups are running over, do we really have to worry about ever running out? To God be all the honor, glory, and praise forever. Amen.
Thanks again to Reverend Timothy Reeves for filling our pulpit this week. Next week on the podcast, Reverend Bill Branch will be filling our pulpit. Reverend Branch is an honorably retired member of the Presbytery of Arkansas. In church news this week, the latest issue of the Central newsletter, The Central Scene, will be hitting email boxes later this week. If you are interested in subscribing, head to our website, www.centralprespb.com. This is the last week to register for Junior High Youth Quake. This trip is for youth in grades 6th through 9th and will take place September 28th through the 30th. For more information, contact the church office or me, Zach Cosner. We are on everyone's favorite social media platforms. Just look for username CentralPresPB. We are also on the web 24/7 at www.centralprespb.com. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, please take a minute to subscribe. We are on Apple Podcasts. We're also in the Google Play Store, and we're on the Stitcher app. Also, we'd appreciate it if you left us a review. It helps people find us. That'll do it for this week's episode. I'm your host, Zach Cosner, and I hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time.